Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Among the many repugnant and reprehensible celebratory statements from the left in the wake of the recent assassination of Turning Point USA founder Charlie Kirk was a short article at Ms. Magazine Online, which reeked of anti-white bigotry and, of course, open misandry or hatred of men. Ms. Magazine, of course, is the longtime flagship mainstream media outlet of the feminist movement. It's predictable that they would look for a response, an interpretation of the shooting and its motivation that would fit their far-left worldview, and sure enough, they didn't disappoint. The spin they gave it is that Charlie Kirk's murder was the inevitable result of his own hegemonic masculinity. What is hegemonic masculinity, you ask, you benighted right-wing extremists? The writer of the article didn't bother to explain, or to put forth any kind of an evidence-based argument, but it has something to do with all kinds of horrible social ills like whiteness, women who make themselves attractive to men, guns, rape culture, male insecurity, whiteness, unequal rights, misogyny, something called the heteropatriarchy, whiteness, having a penis. Did I mention whiteness? Because that's a big part of it. What this tone-deaf, self-righteous, hate-filled screed in Ms. Magazine Online boils down to, though, is that Charlie Kirk's death resulted from Charlie's own brand of masculinity. So basically, he's to blame. And all of us males who flail about, as the article puts it, trying to prove our manhood, participate in that blame, and we're part of a death cult destroying civilization. If you think I'm exaggerating all that, I urge you to read the article. Even more so, I urge you to read a rebuttal to that article by a friend and favorite writer of mine, Janice Fiammingo, at her Substack page, which is called The Fiammingo File. That's F-I-A-M-E-N-G-O. Hers is a devastating critique, not only of the writer of the article, but of feminism itself. As any of you who follows my writing knows, I've written a lot about masculinity over the last dozen years or more, and that's one of the reasons I follow Janice Fiammingo's writing, because her critiques of feminism and the damage it has wrought and continues to wreak on our culture are must-reads. I don't know why it's taken me so long to get her on the show, but I have her on today, and I guarantee you a riveting episode. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. If you're a regular reader of frontpagemag.com, then you know that the motto there is what the late Freedom Center founder David Horowitz used to say, inside every progressive is a totalitarian screaming to get out. And in a similar vein, my guest today at the intersection of politics and culture declares that inside every equality-touting feminist is a man-blaming female supremacist. So that's kind of a bold statement. She is a retired academic from the University of Ottawa who writes on men's issues and anti-feminism at the Fiammingo File Substack, which I cannot recommend highly enough. And her husband happens to be poet and political writer David Solway, a writer I also recommend. I've reviewed a couple of his books before, and I'm actually currently reading his latest one. But back to my guest, Janice Fiammingo. Welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you very much, Mark, for having me on your show.
It's great to have you here finally. There is so much I want to talk to you about, and we're just not going to get to all of it in one episode, so I guess I have to have you back. I've written a lot of over the years about masculinity, so I read you avidly, and I'm grateful, really, for the work that you do on behalf of men who need voices of reason like yours.
Thank you.
Before we dive into the Ms. Magazine article that you so devastatingly deconstructed in your Substack piece that I want to talk about, let me ask you about your career background and how you became the anti-feminist academic. Were you always at odds with feminist orthodoxy, or was there an evolution of some kind for you?
Oh, I was a radical feminist. I bought the line, and I think it's very difficult to be interested in academia without accepting many of the ideologies. And as a naive young person, I just assumed that if everyone said it was true, all of these intelligent people with PhDs, it must be true. And though I had never experienced toxic masculinity in my own life, I thought it must be the case that many women were abused and assaulted and discriminated against and demeaned and objectified in their lives. And so that was a big part of my way of thinking, feminism, I should say. And it really wasn't until I actually began teaching at my first real university position at the University of Saskatchewan that I started to question it all. And I looked out at the sea of young faces in front of me, and it was predominantly female. Most English classes, I taught English literature, most English classes are about 80% female. And the universities as a whole, of course, are female majority and have been since the 1980s. And I looked out at that sea of faces, and I just did not see male privilege or toxic masculinity. I did not see men dominating women. I saw men uncertain of themselves, very eager to please. Men who had been told all their lives that it was women's turn, and that all they could do really in good conscience was take a step back and allow women to take charge of the world, because women were going to do a much better job than men had thus done. And it just struck me quite powerfully that this was a terrible thing to be telling young men, and they were being told that very explicitly in all their classes and in the culture at large. And so I began to question and to reject it at that point. That was in the late 90s. But I really didn't become an actual anti-feminist advocate till about 2012, I would say.
You were still an academic at that point?
Yes,
or was that...
I was, okay. Yeah. And I saw a protest of men's advocate Warren Farrell. He had come to speak at the University of Toronto in the fall of 2012, and a bunch of social justice warriors tried to prevent him from speaking. They were almost successful. They blocked the entranceways and exits and tore down all the posters to his talk and were chanting, you know, ridiculous slogans. This is what men's rights looks like. What it looked yeah. like was a bunch of hysterical students preventing people from attending a talk by a mild-mannered man who spoke about men and boys' difficulties in the world. And I was just so repulsed at that point that I thought I would lend my voice to the campaign against feminism. And so I began speaking on university campuses, and I too had my share of fire alarms pulled and hysterical young people claiming that I was causing violence on the campus.
And didn't that put you in the crosshairs of probably 98% of your peers? I mean, what was it like working in an environment in which you dissented from the orthodoxy?
It wasn't that bad, mostly because I am a woman, so I had my female privilege. It's much easier for women to speak out against feminism and even leftism generally, I think, because it's harder to attack us as oppressors, you know, as toxic, as causing harm. And so I was certainly uncomfortable, but I was mainly uncomfortable because I just hated what I was hearing, and I hated seeing how, you know, thousands of students every year were being sent out as foot soldiers for such destructive, hateful ideologies.
Tell us about the Fiamingo Files video series that you created on YouTube, because that's where I discovered you, as I recall. And I think that material is all still relevant.
Well, thank you. Yes, I think it was the year 2015, after I had done a number of talks. A friend of mine, or he became a friend of mine, he had videoed a number of my talks, one at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and the first one that I ever gave at the University of Toronto. And he asked me if I'd like to do a series. And so I thought that would be really fun. I would never have done it on my own. He had all the technology. We used to go over to his house, and he had a little video studio set up in his basement. And I just started talking about what I had discovered about feminism. And I was especially interested, I think the particular thing that I can bring to discussions of feminism and you know, men's place in feminist culture is that I studied feminism as a graduate student very deeply. And so I've read nearly all the texts. I went back, my particular area of interest was 19th century women's writing and advocacy and activism. So I went back and read the feminists of the 19th century. You know, I studied the first women's rights conference in Seneca Falls, New York in 1848. I read Vindication of the Rights of Women, written in 1792 by Mary Wollstonecraft, and I studied the suffragettes in the late 19th, early 20th century in the UK. So I know that stuff inside and out, and so I know that it isn't true that it just became bad. You know, it just became radical, hateful, unfair, and toxic in the last, whatever you want to say, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years. It was never about equality. It was always hateful. It was always female supremacist. It was always man blaming. It's there in the documents that those feminists produced. It's there in the Declaration of Sentiments from Seneca Falls. So I think that's my the particular thing I want to present to people, is that we can never get back to a better feminism. There is no such thing. We just have to put it in the trash bin of history.
Interesting, because I think most people believe, as I did, that feminism in the early stages, at least, seemed to be about legitimate quests for equality for women, like in the voting booth, for example, and helping them gain legal protections for the workplace and that sort of thing. And they think that second stage feminism, as it's called, is where feminism began to go off the rails and become more about man-hating and gender power struggles and all that. But what you're asserting is that feminism has been a kind of a corrosive man-hating ideology from the very beginning.
It absolutely was, yeah. I have now a second series that I called the Fiammingo File 2.0. The entirety of the original series was banned on YouTube, not because I don't think of anything that I said in the series. It was my co-producer did a series of videos during COVID in which he challenged the COVID narratives. And I think he used the term ivermectin at a time when that was not allowed. And so the whole channel was canceled. It's just very recently been remounted. But we did a second series on the history of, specifically on the history, showing that all of those so-called feminist heroines, all of those texts that were supposedly just about gaining rights so that women could contribute to their societies, that those too were, you know, completely corrupted by female supremacism, resentment, envy, hatred of men. It's there in all of their texts. And it simply isn't true. I mean, we don't have time to get into all of it, but it simply isn't true that they were asking for things that a, you know, misogynistic male dominant society wasn't willing to give. In fact, many, many of the reforms that we associate with feminism, such as the quest for higher education or protections for women in marriage or in the society at large, it simply isn't true that those came as a result of feminism. Most of them, I mean, if you look at the United States, the first institute of higher education that was open to women was Oberlin College in, I believe, 1837. That's long before there was an organized feminist movement. So the idea that men were going to keep women from getting an education just because they wanted to keep them helpless and dependent is simply not true, and right. There was no need for a feminist movement to achieve those kinds of goals for women. The same thing about voting rights and all of that. I mean, the time between all men in various nations having the right to vote and women having the right to vote is vanishingly small. The 19th century was a period when voting rights were being gradually extended to larger and larger numbers of men in the English-speaking world. The idea that women wouldn't have eventually achieved those rights, even with no agitation at all. And in fact, many people argue that the organized feminist movement slowed down the granting of the right to vote to women because women showed themselves to be incapable of possessing that right. They were so hysterical in their claims about why they were being denied it. So it simply isn't the case that feminism was ever simply focused on necessary improvements to women's status.
Yeah. I have some other big picture questions I want to ask you about feminism, but let's drill down for a moment into this Ms. Magazine article about Charlie Kirk, which came out just immediately in the wake of his recent assassination. It's called Dying to Be Men, American Masculinity as Death Cult. And the title alone gives you some sense of just how unhinged the rest of the piece is going to be, and it doesn't disappoint. It's actually a very short piece, but it's jam-packed with these rabidly hateful tropes about the white patriarchy, blah, blah, blah. Is Ms. Magazine still the preeminent feminist publication? And doesn't it seem like they're peddling just the same hateful contempt for men as they were 50 years ago?
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it isn't much of a piece. There's not much. There really isn't. It's a collection of feminist platitudes, and I don't think Emily Taylor, the author, really knew anything about Charlie Kirk. I think that she already had that collection of assertions ready to go, and Kirk's assassination simply became the occasion for her to posted. She originally posted it on her own Substack, and then I guess Ms. picked it up. Maybe she has some association with Ms. I don't know. I don't follow Ms. Magazine, and to tell you the truth, I wasn't even going to write anything about poor Charlie Kirk's murder. Like so many conservatives, I was just I can't exaggerate how hard it hit me.
Yes.
And I was so appalled by the astounding outpouring of malevolent delight that followed it.
Yes.
And you know, not surprisingly, so much of that malevolent delight came from teachers, and especially, of course, teachers in higher education, university teachers. Of course, these are the most committed of the far left's foot soldiers, the intellectuals, and it struck me partly because I became a conservative really largely as a result of spending September 11th in an academic environment where the mood of delight and even exultation I would say was barely contained, and so the feeling I had in relation to Charlie Kirk's assassination was very similar to the feeling that I had on September 11th, and it was, of course, horror at what had happened, but there was this equal or even perhaps greater horror at the knowledge that seemingly decent people were gloating about it. And so I wasn't going to write anything about Charlie Kirk, but when I saw that ridiculous piece in Ms. Magazine, I couldn't resist. And so this is standard, it's just standard boilerplate feminism. Whatever occurs, if in some way it can be blamed on a white conservative Christian man or on, hegemonic masculinity in general, of course, then that's what it will be blamed on because it represents everything that is wrong in the world. But even if a white conservative Christian man is the victim, he is still in some way the author of that violence. And so that's what she's arguing in this piece. He was killed by his own violent discourse. She doesn't really even attempt to make an argument for that, to say why. There are no specific examples. There's no attempt at reasoning. And that's typical of feminist academic work today. I mean, it is amazing to think. I would really encourage, I mean, probably not necessary, but anybody who doesn't realize how vacuous academic feminist discourse is, read this and recognize that this is classic. This is standard. This woman teaches English and gender studies at an American college. And she can't reason her way out of a paper bag. She couldn't have debated Charlie Kirk if her life depended upon it. Right. And yet this is somebody who teaches young people and has the kind of authority that we used to imagine was rightly lodged in academia. And I think it's an interesting piece, not because of anything it says, but just it reminded me that it was really feminism that pioneered the idea that that words are violence, especially words of resistance on the right, that for the left and for feminists in particular, those are violence, and therefore actual violence is an appropriate form of resistance. You know, they have everything turned inside out in that way, and it goes all the way back to Herbert Marcuse, a member of the Frankfurt School. In 1965, he published this famous essay called Repressive Tolerance.
Yes.
And it was the idea that, sure, tolerance is good, but if what you're tolerating is a repressive system, then you're actually tolerating violence.
Yes.
And therefore, violence against repression is what he called liberating violence. It's good violence, perhaps regrettable, but necessary for true tolerance to come about. And that was really the beginning of the left's sanctioning of violence. And feminism, of course, has been a major part of that.
Why are feminists so fixated on white masculinity? They wouldn't dare openly condemn something they called black masculinity, much less black violence or even black on black violence. But they can't smear white men enough, like Charlie Kirk, as violent and hateful bigots. Is it because intersectional feminism is now the norm and the dominant strain of feminism, and so men of color, let's call them, they're off limits to criticism, but white men are sort of the fount of all evil?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. You know, this is not about any actual assessment of who is responsible for violence in our society. It has nothing to do with that. It's only about identity politics. And it is exactly about the fact that white men, especially conservative Christian white men, are at the allegedly the pinnacle of the hierarchy of privilege, and therefore are always the oppressors in any situation and are fair game for the most vicious and unfair attacks. And so this is really what feminist, and I would have to say generally feminine, morality has become. It isn't interested in moral absolutes such as the prohibition on killing, for example, or even the prohibition on taking delight in killing. And I think that that's really interesting that in this piece, even as this woman is expressing a repellent satisfaction in Kirk's murder, she's also at the same time presenting herself and her peers as morally superior to Charlie Kirk. And that is the weird self-contradictory kind of logic that feminism always exhibits. And she genuinely feels, I think, that because she is on the side of victim groups, that she is morally superior to Charlie Kirk, and he can never be a victim in her schema of things because he is on the side of the oppressors. And you know, this is the way that kind of thinking works. One isn't defined by one's actions or by one's principles, certainly not by universal principles, because feminism and the left doesn't believe in universal principles. One is only defined by who one represents, what victim group one represents, or does one represent an oppressor group. There's no nuance, no complexity.
Yeah, and that's identity politics for you.
Yeah.
The smug self-righteousness on the part of the writer of this article and also of her progressive comrades is just off the charts astounding.
It is. It is astounding that on the day after bled out on that stage, that this was considered the appropriate response by a woman who claims to care so deeply about all the vulnerable people in the United States. I mean, yeah, it's so disgusting.
Yes. And you knew that malevolent response was coming, and even so, it was still greater than you and I expected, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You write in your article, your takedown of this Ms. article, you write, and I'm going to quote you here, "Charlie Kirk articulated an age-old vision of the good that we discard at our peril." And you go on to say, "We will either have a patriarchy that conserves our Christian and European inheritance, or we will lose it all," unquote. I totally agree with that, but could you elaborate on that? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so much there.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess, in the largest sense, I have really come to be concerned about the effects of the feminization of our society, which is even more serious in a way than the specific attack on masculine authority and on our European inheritance and on our Christian inheritance. It's even more significant, I think, than the specific harms of feminism. Because what has happened over the past 50 years is something I think more profound maybe than we can even grasp, because we're living through it day by day and it begins to seem normal. But masculine authority and everything that comes along with that has been so profoundly undermined that we are in danger, I think, of losing everything, losing every aspect of our inheritance. I'm a Canadian, but I see myself as having the same inheritance on this continent. And it's been undermined by a feminine authority that will not maintain any of the bedrock principles of our culture. Male civilization is about building, ordering, creating systems. It's about the rule of law. It's about an attempt at objectivity. It's about the valuing of equality before the law. It's about the valuing of the pursuit of truth. It is absolutely essential to everything that matters to us. And more and more polls show, in general, when women become a near majority or even supermajority in any domain, that everything, all of those values in that domain change and they become feminine values. And more and more polls show that women are not very interested in free speech. If they have to choose between free speech and the value of inclusion or protecting feelings of the vulnerable, free speech will just have to go. They're not very interested in the pursuit of truth. They're not very interested in the rule of law. They're interested in feeling. They're interested in moral intuition. You know, they're interested in the idea of who is vulnerable in this situation and how can they be protected from the predators out there. It's very much an us and them kind of ideology. And I'm very concerned that we are experiencing the creation of an entirely new moral landscape that is completely different from what we have experienced before. Now, of course, this is not to say that there aren't, you know, good women who can be, you know, fantastic academics or judges or whatever have you. But in general, when any sphere of society becomes feminized, the fundamental values that have underpinned our civilization, which has created so many wonderful things, those fundamental values are in peril. And in fact, I don't think they can be sustained. We are living through an experiment now that has, you know, completely unprecedented. We've never, there have been very many societies in the past where women had power, but never to the extent that we are witnessing now, with, you know, where you have heads of police who are women, where you have, you know, 50% of business owners are women, where the majority of white collar workers are women, where 30% of judges are women. And how can you have judges when many women absolutely do not believe in the fundamental principles of Western jurisprudence and say they don't believe in it? You know, feminist academics, professors of law, they're open about the fact that they don't believe in those principles. So that's really my big concern now, is that we allowed masculine authority to be so deeply undermined that even now, like, any man who has power, he may have nominal power, but he doesn't really have authority anymore. He's just one accusation away from losing everything. And I think every man who's paying attention must know that that is the case. So we've allowed masculine authority to be so completely undermined and replaced by this thing that we don't even understand. And it is not interested in the same values. And So I really do think we are at a tipping point now, just in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. We're really starting to understand what a society looks like when it's dominated by feminine principles rather than masculine principles, in which everything in a way becomes a morality play, in which the question is not what are the facts, what are the evidence, what are the principles. The question is, whose side are you on? And, you know, intent doesn't matter anymore. That's being replaced by impact, maybe. Evidence is replaced by powerful stories. Justice is replaced by validating the victim. And, I don't know whether all that we most value in our societies can be maintained if we're going to keep going in the way we're going.
Well, you really anticipated a question that I was going to ask about the importance of masculinity to the flourishing of civilization. You pretty much just covered that, especially at a time now when feminists sneer at the idea that men are in crisis, that men have legitimate issues we need to resolve. They literally question what men are good for. You know, their rallying cry is the future is female. And I was going to ask you, what is it that these women and male feminists too get wrong about masculinity? But you,
they get everything wrong about it. That's not, you know, they get some little tiny sliver right, and I don't think there are any men, even the most committed patriarchs, who would deny that there is a shadow side to masculinity. And we know what it looks like. It looks like domination. It looks like violence. It looks like, you know, over-competitiveness and all those things. We're very well aware of all of that. As a society, we are ill-equipped now to recognize what is good about masculinity, what is necessary about it, and we're also very ill-equipped to see and articulate the shadow side of femininity. So in a way, that's what I see as my, that's my reason for being right now in my writing life, is to try to highlight what that looks like. And I mean, it's just amazing to me how many women feel free to pronounce about how, you know, how men have become irrelevant and men are obsolete. There was even a monk debate in the city of Toronto about 10 years ago with that. That was the title, you know, Men Are Obsolete. Four women debated whether they were or not. And, you know, it's just ridiculous. Men built our civilization, period. And they continue to build and maintain. So many women don't even know what men do. You know, it's amazing. They don't understand what kind of ingenuity and dedication and sweat and strength is required to build and maintain, you know, the electrical grid, the roads, the bridges, all the structures, the air conditioning, the heating systems, the water and sewage systems, the whole transportation network, the air traffic control system, you know, the bulk of policing, firefighting, frontline soldiering, everything. You know, that's what men do. And, it's astounding to me that women, many women, not all, of course, and a lot of men too, are willing to throw that, all of that out, and to throw out the principles that I talked about as well, in favor of some experiment that we absolutely can't even imagine, and that so far has not shown itself to be working very well. I don't find that women make very good leaders. Men are leaders. Men have been, you know, men have developed over the centuries to become leaders, to take on the responsibility, to take on the criticism that comes. What happens when we have a woman leader who fails in some way? She cries in public, and we're supposed to all feel sorry for her and forgive her for her failings. It is very concerning to me that we are willing to throw out so much that is very, very valuable in our civilization for a very dubious end, because we accepted the idea that masculinity is somehow contaminated. Yes. So, and it simply is not.
You mentioned a moment ago that, you know, there are a lot of women who don't believe this, and so that leads into my question. What is the current state of feminism? By that I mean, I saw a poll several years ago, can't recall how long ago, maybe as far as 10 years ago now, which indicated that a significant majority of young women did not identify as feminists, which kind of suggested that they were rejecting a label which had come to have negative connotations. But did that necessarily mean that they rejected feminism's core assumptions? So I'm not sure what the state of feminism is currently. Is it mostly just the domain of our cultural elites while there's a silent majority that does not subscribe to it? What is the deal?
I'm not sure about that. My fear is that despite the fact that it's true many women would reject the label, that they have so deeply imbibed essentially feminist beliefs and assumptions that it doesn't really matter anymore. I mean, I really do think feminism has been so successful in becoming the norm that it doesn't matter whether one, you know, specifically identifies as that or not. You know, the as far as I can see, the evidence seems to indicate, and I hope this won't necessarily be the future, but right now the evidence seems to indicate that there is a vast divergence in terms of interests, values, political beliefs, etc., between young men and young women. Young women seem in general to be getting somewhat more liberal, whereas young men are becoming more conservative in general and rejecting the toxic narrative that they've been told. And I am just hoping that eventually young men standing up for their beliefs and being courageous in declaring what they are will be so attractive to those young women that they will eventually reject the beliefs that they have accepted. And I think there's a possibility of that, because I think men declaring what they believe and showing their strength, their moral strength and their integrity, I think that is incredibly powerful.
Yes.
And I think it will attract a lot of women, because I think women, women are naturally attracted to that. So that's my hope, but I'm not sure that that is the case right now. I think, I think there's a moral hazard in telling a group of people that they have been victims from the beginning of time, that they are owed everything, that nothing they do can ever be criticized, that if they are criticized, they can make a hue and cry, and people will back down, or people will praise them for having the courage to resist. And I think that is what has been done to women and other groups in our society as well, and I think it is having an effect. A lot of women don't take responsibility for their choices. A lot of women find it quite pleasurable, I think, to declare themselves valiant victims and to be praised for that.
Sure.
You know, it is an intoxicating, very seductive kind of identity to take on. So I'm worried about that. And that's why anti-feminism is the radical idea that women are adults and that women can take responsibility and can give up the victim label and choose to be responsible for themselves and to care more about the good of society than their own pleasure and happiness. And right now, I think women are being encouraged to think only about what is making them happy right now. What do you want right now? And we still hear that, on the part of feminists. Women want this. Women need this. Women aren't happy about this. True adulthood and maturity is recognizing that your own personal happiness is not a feeling that you should pursue, that happiness is a good life. It is a life of virtue. It is based on rational principles and ethical conduct. Until women can fully embrace that, they're not going to be adults in their societies. And I think that's really too bad. But I hope that they will decide to pursue that, because they will be much more content if they do. And I think they will then, I hope, recognize the importance of joining with men to create a flourishing, ordered society that's good for the raising of children, because those are the only things that really matter. And as I said in the article, the sterile narcissism of women's sexual freedoms and, all of the discussion that we hear today, that is clearly, civilizationally, if not personally, a dead end. And so I just hope that will become more and more apparent to more and more women.
All very well said. And as far as the men are concerned, for years now, as you know, there's been this backlash among men against these decades of being battered by feminist contempt. And so young men now seem to be asserting, or at least seeking to reclaim, a sense of dignity and value, which is a good thing. Should we be wary of the backlash swinging too far in the opposite direction? In other words, is there not some ideal middle ground where the sexes can find the right harmony without bitterness and resentment on either side?
Yeah, sure, of course. It is possible that the pendulum will swing too far and that there'll be some sort of backlash is damaging. I think you're speaking to the wrong person about that, and that it's just not something I'm worried about. I speak to a lot of men of all ages, and my impression of men is that they have, the vast majority of them, even those who have been burned, in horrible divorces, they've lost touch with their children because their ex-wives lied about them, said they were abusive, they weren't, and they haven't been able to see their kids. They've had terrible experiences with false allegations. Some have been wrongfully incarcerated. Just terrible, terrible experiences. And despite those, I just do not find in men the hatred, the misogyny, the contempt, the bitterness mm-hmm. that allegedly is there, you know, and that has always been there, and we need to be so worried about. It isn't. Men have a very deep love, if not of every individual woman in the world, certainly of women in general, a very deep desire to live in partnership with women. They're just not interested in oppressing women. And so I don't worry about the pendulum swinging. I really look forward to a day when I hope men will be able to take positions. I think we should live in a society where men are the majority of the leaders. And I think men are interested in leading well, and they will lead with the goodness, the good of women in mind. And I don't think we need to fear misogyny or men's contempt for women, because I just don't see it.
Janice, I understand that you have a book forthcoming early next year about feminism.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a collection of essays. Some of them will be my Substack newsletter essays, some original pieces that I'm writing. It's going to combine commentary on contemporary issues with some reflection on the history of feminism and feminist figures and issues, and it's called tentatively titled anyway, The Goddess That Failed, Feminism's Never-Ending Assault on Men, Families, and Civilization Itself.
Oh man, I will be looking forward to that. How can people best keep up with what you are writing and thinking?
Well, I would love it if they would come and look at my Substack. I think if you just put the Fiamengo file into any search engine, it should come up. Or if you add Substack, it would, I guess, direct anyone there. And I try to write there at least, once every 10 days or so. And I have a very robust and usually civil comment section that I'm very proud of. Not always civil, but usually. And I would really invite anyone interested to take a look at my essays there and to join in the comment section.
Good to know. Listeners, I urge you to check out Janice's work because it is really vital. And I'm an avid reader of her Substack page, so I cannot recommend it highly enough. Janice Fiamengo, thanks for joining us at The Right Take. There's just so much more to dive into about the war on masculinity, but I try to keep these episodes at a fairly digestible length, so I'll just have to have you back. But keep up the great work.
Well, thank you very much, Mark.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.